An agreed to follow this plan, and everything took place as arranged. On Nureddin's return, Khakan pretended to be about to slay him, but yielding to his wife's intercession, said to his son, "You owe your life to your mother. I pardon you on her intercession, and on the conditions that you take the beautiful Persian for your wife, and not your slave, that you never sell her, nor put her away." Nureddin, not hoping for so great indulgence, thanked his father and vowed to do as he desired. Khakan was at great pains frequently to speak to the king of the difficulties attending the commission he had given him, but some whispers of what had actually taken place did reach Saui's ears. More than a year after these events, the minister took a chill, leaving the bath while still heated, to go out on important business. This resulted in inflammation of the lungs, which rapidly increased. The vizier, feeling that his end was at hand, sent for Nureddin, and charged him with his dying breath, never to part with the beautiful Persian. Shortly afterwards he expired, leaving universal regret throughout the kingdom. Rich and poor alike followed him to the grave. Nureddin showed every mark of the deepest grief at his father's death, and for long refused to see anyone. At length a day came when, one of his friends being admitted, urged him strongly to be consoled, and to resume his former place in society. This advice Nureddin was not slow to follow, and soon he formed a little society of 10 young men all about his own age, with whom he spent all his time in continual feasting and merrymaking. Sometimes the fair Persian consented to appear at these festivities, but she disapproved of this lavish expenditure, and did not scruple to warn Nureddin of the probable consequences. He, however, only laughed at her advice, saying that his father had always kept him in too great constraint, and that now he rejoiced at his newfound liberty. What added to the confusion in his affairs was that he refused to look into his accounts with his steward, sending him away every time he appeared with his book. "See only that I live well," he said, "and do not disturb me about anything else." Not only did Nureddin's friends constantly partake of his hospitality, but in every way they took advantage of his generosity. Everything of his that they admired, whether land, houses, baths, or any other source of his revenue, he immediately bestowed on them. In vain the Persian protested against the wrong he did himself. He continued to scatter with the same lavish hand. Throughout one entire year, Nureddin did nothing but amuse himself and dissipate the wealth his father had taken such pains to acquire. The year had barely elapsed when one day, as they sat at table, there came a knock at the door. The slaves having been sent away, Nureddin went to open it himself. One of his friends had risen at the same time, but Nureddin was before him, and finding the intruder to be the steward, he went out and closed the door. The friend, curious to hear what passed between them, hid himself behind the hangings and heard the following words.
"My lord," said the steward, "I beg a thousand pardons for interrupting you, but what I have long foreseen has taken place. Nothing remains of the sums you gave me for your expenses, and all other sources of income are also at end, having been transferred by you to others. If you wish me to remain in your service, furnish me with the necessary funds, else I must withdraw."
So great was Nureddin's consternation that he had not a word to say in reply. The friend, who had been listening behind the curtain, immediately hastened to communicate the news to the rest of the company.
"If this is so," they said, "we must cease to come here."
Nureddin, re-entering at that moment, they plainly saw, in spite of his efforts to dissemble, that what they heard was the truth. One by one they rose, and each with a different excuse left the room, till presently he found himself alone, though little suspecting the resolution his friends had taken. Then, seeking the beautiful Persian, he confided to her the statement of the steward, with many expressions of regret for his own carelessness.
"Had I but followed your advice, beautiful Persian," he said, "all this would not have happened. But at least I have this consolation, that I have spent my fortune in the company of friends who will not desert me in an hour of need. Tomorrow I will go to them, and amongst them they will lend me a sum sufficient to start in some business. Accordingly, next morning early, Nureddin went to seek his 10 friends, who all lived in the same street. Knocking at the door of the first and chief, the slave who opened it left him to wait in a hall while he announced his visit to his master.
"Nureddin,"
he heard him exclaim quite audibly,
"tell him every time he calls that I am not at home."
The same thing happened at the second door, and also at the third, and so on with all the 10. Nureddin, much mortified, recognized too late that he had confided in false friends, who abandoned him in his hour of need. Overwhelmed with grief, he sought consolation from the beautiful Persian.
"Alas, my lord," she said, "at last you are convinced of the truth of what I foretold. There is now no other resource left but to sell your slaves and your furniture."
First, then, he sold the slaves, and subsisted for a time on the proceeds. After that, the furniture was sold, and as much of it was valuable, it sufficed for some time. Finally, this resource also came to an end, and again he sought counsel from the beautiful Persian.
"My lord," she said, "I know that the late vizier, your father, bought me for 10,000 gold pieces, and though I have diminished in value since, I should still fetch a large sum. Do not, therefore, hesitate to sell me, and with the money you obtain, go and establish yourself in business in some distant town."
"Charming Persian," answered Nureddin, "how could I be guilty of such baseness? I would die rather than part from you, whom I love better than my life."
"My lord," she replied, "I am well aware of your love for me, which is only equaled by mine for you. But a cruel necessity obliges us to seek the only remedy."
Nureddin, convinced at length of the truth of her words, yielded, and reluctantly led her to the slave market, where, showing her to a dealer named Haji Hassan, he inquired her value. Taking them into a room apart, Haji Hassan exclaimed as soon as she had unveiled,
"My lord, is not this the slave your father bought for 10,000 pieces?"
On learning that it was so, he promised to obtain the highest possible price for her. Leaving the beautiful Persian shut up in the room alone, he went out to seek the slave merchants, announcing to them that he had found the pearl among slaves, and asking them to come and put a value upon her. As soon as they saw her, they agreed that less than 4,000 gold pieces could not be asked. Haji Hassan, then closing the door upon her, began to offer her for sale, calling out,
"Who will bid 4,000 gold pieces for the Persian slave?"
Before any of the merchants had bid, Sa'ui happened to pass that way, and judging that it must be a slave of extraordinary beauty, rode up to Haji Hassan and desired to see her. Now it was not the custom to show a slave to a private bidder, but as no one dared to disobey the vizier, his request was granted. As soon as Sa'ui saw the Persian, he was so struck by her beauty that he immediately wished to possess her, and not knowing that she belonged to Nureddin, he desired Haji Hassan to send for the owner and to conclude the bargain at once. Haji Hassan then sought Nureddin, and told him that his slave was going far below her value, and that if Sa'ui bought her, he was capable of not paying the money.
"What you must do,"
he said,
"is to pretend that you had no real intention of selling your slave, and only swore you would in a fit of anger against her. When I present her to Sa'ui, as if with your consent, you must step in, and with blows begin to lead her away."
Nureddin did as Haji Hassan advised, to the great wrath of Sa'ui, who, riding straight at him, endeavored to take the beautiful Persian from him by force. Nureddin, letting her go, seized Sa'ui's horse by the bridle, and, encouraged by the applause of the bystanders, dragged him to the ground, beat him severely, and left him in the gutter streaming with blood. Then, taking the beautiful Persian, he returned home amidst the acclamations of the people, who detest Sa'ui so much that they would neither interfere in his behalf nor allow his slaves to protect him. Covered from head to foot with mire and streaming with blood, he rose, and leaning on two of his slaves went straight to the palace, where he demanded an audience of the king, to whom he related what had taken place in these words.
May it please your majesty, I had gone to the slave market to buy myself a cook. While there I heard a slave being offered for 4,000 pieces. Asking to see her, I found she was of incomparable beauty, and was being sold by Nureddin, the son of your late vizier, to whom your majesty will remember giving a sum of 10,000 gold pieces for the purchase of a slave. This is the identical slave whom, instead of bringing to your majesty, he gave to his own son. Since the death of his father, this Nureddin has run through his entire fortune, has sold all his possessions, and is now reduced to selling the slave. Calling him to me, I said, Nureddin, I will give you 10,000 gold pieces for your slave, whom I will present to the king. I will interest him at the same time in your behalf, and this will be worth much more to you than what extra money you might obtain from the merchants. Bad old man, he exclaimed, rather than sell my slave to you, I would give her to a Jew. But Nureddin, I remonstrated, you do not consider that in speaking thus you wrong the king, to whom your father owed everything. This remonstrance only irritated him the more. Throwing himself on me like a madman, he tore me from my horse, beat me to his heart's content, and left me in the state your majesty sees.
So saying, Sa'ui turned aside his head and wept bitterly. The king's wrath was kindled against Nureddin. He ordered the captain of the guard to take with him 40 men, to pillage Nureddin's house, to raze it to the ground, and to bring Nureddin and the slave to him. A doorkeeper named Sangiar, who had been a slave of Kakan's, hearing this order given, slipped out of the king's apartment and hastened to warn Nureddin to take flight instantly with a beautiful Persian. Then, presenting him with 40 gold pieces, he disappeared before Nureddin had time to thank him. As soon, then, as the fair Persian had put on her veil, they fled together, and had the good fortune to get out of the town without being observed. At the mouth of the Euphrates they found a ship just about to start for Baghdad. They embarked, and immediately the anchor was raised, and they set sail. When the captain of the guard reached Nureddin's house, he caused his soldiers to burst open the door and to enter by force. But no trace was to be found of Nureddin and his slave, nor could the neighbors give any information about them. When the king heard that they had escaped, he issued a proclamation that a reward of 1,000 gold pieces would be given to whoever would bring him Nureddin and the slave, but that, on the contrary, whoever hid them would be severely punished. Meanwhile, Nureddin and the fair Persian had safely reached Baghdad. When the vessel had come to an anchor, they paid 5 gold pieces for their passage and went ashore. Never having been to Baghdad before, they did not know where to seek a lodging. Wandering along the banks of the Tigris, they skirted a garden enclosed by a high wall. The gate was shut, but in front of it was an open vestibule with a sofa on either side.
Here, said Nureddin, let us pass the night.
And reclining on the sofas, they soon fell asleep. Now this garden belonged to the caliph. In the middle of it was a vast pavilion, whose superb saloon had 80 windows, each window having a luster, lit solely when the caliph spent the evening there. Only the doorkeeper lived there, an old soldier named Sheikh Ibrahim, who had strict orders to be very careful whom he admitted, and never to allow anyone to sit on the sofas by the door. It happened that evening that he had gone out on an errand. When he came back and saw 2 persons asleep on the sofas, he was about to drive them out with blows, but drawing nearer he perceived that they were a handsome young man and beautiful young woman, and decided to awake them by gentler means. Nureddin, on being awoke, told the old man that they were strangers, and merely wished to pass the night there.
"Come with me," said Sheikh Ibrahim. "I will lodge you better, and will show you a magnificent garden belonging to me."
So saying, the doorkeeper led the way into the caliph's garden, the beauties of which filled them with wonder and amazement. Nureddin took out 2 gold pieces, and giving them to Sheikh Ibrahim, said,
"I beg you to get us something to eat, that we may make merry together."
Being very avaricious, Sheikh Ibrahim determined to spend only the 10th part of the money and to keep the rest to himself. While he was gone, Nureddin and the Persian wandered through the gardens and went up the white marble staircase of the pavilion as far as the locked door of the saloon. On the return of Sheikh Ibrahim, they begged him to open it, and to allow them to enter and admire the magnificence within. Consenting, he brought not only the key, but a light, and immediately unlocked the door. Nureddin and the Persian, entering, were dazzled with the magnificence they beheld. The paintings and furniture were of astonishing beauty, and between each window was a silver arm holding a candle. Sheikh Ibrahim spread the table in front of a sofa, and all three ate together. When they had finished eating, Nureddin asked the old man to bring them a bottle of wine.
"Heaven forbid," said Sheikh Ibrahim, "that I should come in contact with wine. I, who have four times made the pilgrimage to Mecca, and have renounced wine forever."
"You would, however, do us a great service in procuring us some," said Nureddin. "You need not touch it yourself. Take the ass which is tied to the gate, lead it to the nearest wine shop, and ask some passer-by to order two jars of wine, have them put in the ass's panniers, and drive him before you. Here are two pieces of gold for the expenses."
At the sight of the gold, Sheikh Ibrahim set off at once to execute the commission. On his return, Nureddin said,
"We have still need of cups to drink from, and of fruit, if you can procure us some."
Sheikh Ibrahim disappeared again, and soon returned with a table spread with cups of gold and silver, and every sort of beautiful fruit. Then he withdrew, in spite of repeated invitations to remain. Nureddin and the beautiful Persian, finding the wine excellent, drank of it freely, and while drinking they sang. Both had fine voices, and Sheikh Ibrahim listened to them with great pleasure. First from a distance, then he drew nearer, and finally put his head in at the door. Nureddin, seeing him, called to him to come in and keep them company. At first the old man declined, but was persuaded to enter the room, to sit down on the edge of the sofa nearest the door, and at last to draw closer, and to seat himself by the beautiful Persian, who urged him so persistently to drink her health, that at length he yielded, and took the cup she offered. Now the old man only made a pretense of renouncing wine. He frequented wine shops like other people, and had taken none of the precautions Nureddin had proposed. Having once yielded, he was easily persuaded to take a second cup, and a third, and so on, till he no longer knew what he was doing. Till near midnight they continued drinking, laughing, and singing together. About that time the Persian, perceiving that the room was lit by only one miserable tallow candle, asked Sheikh Ibrahim to light some of the beautiful candles in the silver arms.
"Light them yourself," answered the old man. "You are younger than I, but let five or six be enough."
She did not stop, however, till she had lit all 80. But Sheikh Ibrahim was not conscious of this, and when, soon after that, Nureddin proposed to have some of the lusters lit, he answered,
"You are more capable of lighting them than I, but not more than three."
Nureddin, far from contenting himself with three, lit all, and opened all the 80 windows. The Caliph Harun al-Rashid, chancing at that moment to open a window in the saloon of his palace looking on the garden, was surprised to see the pavilion brilliantly illuminated. Calling the Grand Vizier, Jafar, he said to him,
"Negligent Vizier, look at the pavilion, and tell me why it is lit up when I am not there."
When the vizier saw that it was as the caliph said, he trembled with fear, and immediately invented an excuse.
"Commander of the faithful," he said, "I must tell you that 4 or 5 days ago, Sheikh Ibrahim told me that he wished to have an assembly of the ministers of his mosque, and asked permission to hold it in the pavilion. I granted his request, but forgot since to mention it to your majesty."
"Jafar," replied the caliph, "you have committed three faults. First, in giving the permission. Second, in not mentioning it to me. And third, in not investigating the matter more closely. For punishment, I condemn you to spend the rest of the night with me in company of these worthy people. While I dress myself as a citizen, go and disguise yourself, and then come with me."
When they reached the garden gate, they found it open, to the great indignation of the caliph. The door of the pavilion being also open, he went softly upstairs and looked in at the half-closed door of the saloon. Great was his surprise to see Sheikh Ibrahim, whose sobriety he had never doubted, drinking and singing with a young man and a beautiful lady. The caliph, before giving way to his anger, determined to watch and see who the people were and what they did. Presently, Sheikh Ibrahim asked the beautiful Persian if anything were wanting to complete her enjoyment of the evening.
"If only," she said, "I had an instrument upon which I might play."
Sheikh Ibrahim immediately took a lute from a cupboard and gave it to the Persian, who began to play on it, singing the while with such skill and taste that the caliph was enchanted. When she ceased, he went softly downstairs and said to the vizier,
"Never have I heard a finer voice, nor the lute better played. I am determined to go in and make her play for me."
"Commander of the faithful," said the vizier, "if Sheikh Ibrahim recognizes you, he will die of fright."
"I should be sorry for that," answered the caliph, "and I am going to take steps to prevent it. Wait here till I return."
Now the caliph had caused a bend in the river to form a lake in his garden. There the finest fishes in the Tigris were to be found, but fishing was strictly forbidden. It happened that night, however, that a fisherman had taken advantage of the gate being open to go in and cast his nets. He was just about to draw them when he saw the caliph approaching. Recognizing him at once in spite of his disguise, he threw himself at his feet, imploring forgiveness.
"Fear nothing," said the caliph. "Only rise up and draw thy nets."
The fisherman did as he was told, and produced 5 or 6 fine fish, of which the caliph took the 2 largest. Then he desired the fisherman to change clothes with him, and in a few minutes the caliph was transformed into a fisherman, even to the shoes and the turban. Taking the 2 fish in his hand, he returned to the vizier, who, not recognizing him, would have sent him about his business. Leaving the vizier at the foot of the stairs, the caliph went up and knocked at the door of the saloon. Nureddin opened it, and the caliph, standing on the threshold, said,
"Sheikh Ibrahim, I am the fisher Kerim. Seeing that you are feasting with your friends, I bring you these fish."
Nureddin and the Persian said that when the fishes were properly cooked and dressed, they would gladly eat of them. The caliph then returned to the vizier, and they set to work in Sheikh Ibrahim's house to cook the fish, of which they made so tempting a dish that Nureddin and the fair Persian ate of it with great relish. When they had finished, Nureddin took 30 gold pieces, all that remained of what Sangiar had given him, and presented them to the caliph, who, thanking him, asked as a further favor if the lady would play him 1 piece on the lute. The Persian gladly consented, and sang and played so as to delight the caliph. Nureddin, in the habit of giving to others whatever they admired, said,
"Fisherman, as she pleases you so much, take her. She is yours."
The fair Persian, astounded that he should wish to part from her, took her lute, and with tears in her eyes, sang her reproaches to its music. The caliph, still in the character of fisherman, said to him,
"Sir, I perceive that this fair lady is your slave. Oblige me, I beg you, by relating your history."
Nureddin willingly granted this request, and recounted everything from the purchase of the slave down to the present moment.
"And where do you go now?"
asked the caliph.
"Wherever the hand of Allah leads me," said Nureddin.
"Then, if you will listen to me," said the caliph, "you will immediately return to Balsora. I will give you a letter to the king, which will ensure you a good reception from him."
"It is an unheard-of thing," said Nureddin, "that a fisherman should be in correspondence with a king."
"Let not that astonish you," answered the caliph. "We studied together, and have always remained the best of friends. Though fortune, while making him a king, left me a humble fisherman."
The caliph then took a sheet of paper and wrote the following letter, at the top of which he put in very small characters this formula to show that he must be implicitly obeyed. In the name of the Most Merciful God.
Letter of the Caliph Harun al-Rashid to the King of Balsora. Harun al-Rashid, son of Mahdi, sends this letter to Muhammad Zinebi, his cousin. As soon as Nur ed-Din, son of the Vizier Khakan, bearer of this letter, has given it to thee, and thou hast read it, take off thy royal mantle, put it on his shoulders, and seat him in thy place without fail. Farewell.
The caliph then gave this letter to Nur ed-Din, who immediately set off, with only what little money he possessed when Sangiar came to his assistance. The beautiful Persian, inconsolable at his departure, sank on a sofa, bathed in tears. When Nur ed-Din had left the room, Sheikh Ibrahim, who had hitherto kept silence, said,
Karim, for two miserable fish thou hast received a purse and a slave. I tell thee I will take the slave, and as to the purse, if it contains silver, thou mayst keep one piece. If gold, then I will take all, and give thee what copper pieces I have in my purse.
Now here it must be related that when the caliph went upstairs with the plate of fish, he ordered the vizier to hasten to the palace and bring back four slaves bearing a change of raiment, who should wait outside the pavilion till the caliph should clap his hands. Still personating the fisherman, the caliph answered,
Sheikh Ibrahim, whatever is in the purse I will share equally with you, but as to the slave, I will keep her for myself. If you do not agree to these conditions, you shall have nothing.
The old man, furious at this insolence as he considered it, took a cup and threw it at the caliph, who easily avoided a missile from the hand of a drunken man. It hit against the wall and broke into 1,000 pieces. Sheikh Ibrahim, still more enraged, then went out to fetch a stick. The caliph at that moment clapped his hands, and the vizier and the four slaves entering took off the fisherman's dress and put on him that which they had brought. When Sheikh Ibrahim returned, a thick stick in his hand, the caliph was seated on his throne, and nothing remained of the fisherman but his clothes in the middle of the room. Throwing himself on the ground at the caliph's feet, he said,
Commander of the faithful, your miserable slave has offended you and craves forgiveness.
The caliph came down from his throne and said,
Rise, I forgive thee.
Then turning to the Persian, he said,
Fair lady, now you know who I am. Learn also that I have sent Nur ed-Din to Balsora to be king, and as soon as all necessary preparations are made, I will send you there to be queen. Meanwhile, I will give you an apartment in my palace, where you will be treated with all honor.
At this, the beautiful Persian took courage, and the caliph was as good as his word, recommending her to the care of his wife, Zobeidah. Nur ed-Din made all haste on his journey to Balsora, and on his arrival there went straight to the palace of the king, of whom he demanded an audience. It was immediately granted, and holding the letter high above his head, he forced his way through the crowd. While the king read the letter, he changed color. He would instantly have executed the caliph's order, but first he showed the letter to Saui, whose interests were equally at stake with his own. Pretending that he wished to read it a second time, Saui turned aside as if to seek a better light. Unperceived by anyone, he tore off the formula from the top of the letter, put it to his mouth, and swallowed it. Then turning to the king, he said,
Your Majesty has no need to obey this letter. The writing is indeed that of the caliph, but the formula is absent. Besides, he has not sent an express with the patent, without which the letter is useless. Leave all to me, and I will take the consequences.
The king not only listened to the persuasions of Saui, but gave Nur ed-Din into his hands. Such a severe bastinado was first administered to him that he was left more dead than alive. Then Saui threw him into the darkest and deepest dungeon, and fed him only on bread and water. After 10 days, Saui determined to put an end to Nur ed-Din's life, but dared not without the king's authority. To gain this end, he loaded several of his own slaves with rich gifts, and presented himself at their head to the king, saying that they were from the new king on his coronation.
What? Said the king. Is that wretch still alive? Go and behead him at once. I authorize you.
Sire, said Sa'ui, I thank your majesty for the justice you do me. I would further beg, as Nur ed-Din publicly affronted me, that the execution might be in front of the palace, and that it might be proclaimed throughout the city, so that no one may be ignorant of it.
The king granted these requests, and the announcement caused universal grief, for the memory of Nur ed-Din's father was still fresh in the hearts of his people. Sa'ui, accompanied by 20 of his own slaves, went to the prison to fetch Nur ed-Din, whom he mounted on a wretched horse without a saddle. Arrived at the palace, Sa'ui went in to the king, leaving Nur ed-Din in the square, hemmed in not only by Sa'ui's slaves, but by the royal guard, who had great difficulty in preventing the people from rushing in and rescuing Nur ed-Din. So great was the indignation against Sa'ui that if anyone had set the example, he would have been stoned on his way through the streets. Sa'ui, who witnessed the agitation of the people from the windows of the king's privy chambers, called to the executioner to strike at once. The king, however, ordered him to delay. Not only was he jealous of Sa'ui's interference, but he had another reason. A troop of horsemen was seen at that moment riding at full gallop towards the square. Sa'ui suspected who they might be, and urged the king to give the signal for the execution without delay, but this the king refused to do till he knew who the horsemen were. Now they were the vizier Ja'far and his suite, arriving at full speed from Baghdad. For several days after Nur ed-Din's departure with the letter, the caliph had forgotten to send the express with the patent, without which the letter was useless. Hearing a beautiful voice one day in the women's part of the palace uttering lamentations, he was informed that it was the voice of the fair Persian, and suddenly calling to mind the patent, he sent for Ja'far and ordered him to make for Balsora with the utmost speed. If Nur ed-Din were dead, to hang Sa'ui. If he were still alive, to bring him at once to Baghdad along with the king and Sa'ui. Ja'far rode at full speed through the square, and alighted at the steps of the palace, where the king came to greet him. The vizier's first question was whether Nur ed-Din was still alive. The king replied that he was, and he was immediately led forth, though bound hand and foot. By the vizier's orders, his bonds were immediately undone, and Sa'ui was tied with the same cords. Next day, Ja'far returned to Baghdad, bearing with him the king, Sa'ui, and Nur ed-Din. When the caliph heard what treatment Nur ed-Din had received, he authorized him to behead Sa'ui with his own hands. But he declined to shed the blood of his enemy, who was forthwith handed over to the executioner. The caliph also desired Nur ed-Din to reign over Balsora, but this too he declined, saying that after what had passed there, he preferred never to return, but to enter the service of the caliph. He became one of the most intimate courtiers, and lived long in great happiness with the fair Persian. As to the king, the caliph contented himself with sending him back to Balsora, with the recommendation to be more careful in the future in the choice of his vizier.
Aladdin and the Wonderful Lamp. There once lived a poor tailor, who had a son called Aladdin, a careless, idle boy, who would do nothing but play all day long in the streets with little idle boys like himself. This so grieved the father that he died. Yet, in spite of his mother's tears and prayers, Aladdin did not mend his ways. One day, when he was playing in the streets as usual, a stranger asked him his age, and if he were not the son of Mustafa the tailor.
I am, sir, replied Aladdin, but he died a long while ago.
On this, the stranger, who was a famous African magician, fell on his neck and kissed him, saying,
I am your uncle, and knew you from your likeness to my brother. Go to your mother and tell her I am coming.
Aladdin ran home and told his mother of his newly found uncle.
Indeed, child, she said, your father had a brother, but I always thought he was dead.
However, she prepared supper,
and bade Aladdin to seek his uncle, who came laden with wine and fruit. He presently fell down and kissed the place where Mustafa used to sit, bidding Aladdin's mother not to be surprised at not having seen him before, as he had been 40 years out of the country. He then turned to Aladdin and asked him his trade, at which the boy hung his head, while his mother burst into tears. On learning that Aladdin was idle and would learn no trade, he offered to take a shop for him and stock it with merchandise. Next day he bought Aladdin a fine suit of clothes and took him all over the city, showing him the sights, and brought him home at nightfall to his mother, who was overjoyed to see her son so fine. Next day the magician led Aladdin into some beautiful gardens a long way outside the city gates. They sat down by a fountain, and the magician pulled a cake from his girdle, which he divided between them. They then journeyed onwards till they almost reached the mountains. Aladdin was so tired that he begged to go back, but the magician beguiled him with pleasant stories and led him on in spite of himself. At last they came to two mountains divided by a narrow valley.
"We will go no farther," said the false uncle. "I will show you something wonderful. Only do you gather up sticks while I kindle a fire."
When it was lit, the magician threw on it a powder he had about him, at the same time saying some magical words. The earth trembled a little and opened in front of them, disclosing a square, flat stone with a brass ring in the middle to raise it by. Aladdin tried to run away, but the magician caught him and gave him a blow that knocked him down.
"What have I done, uncle?"
he said piteously, whereupon the magician said more kindly,
"Fear nothing, but obey me. Beneath this stone lies a treasure which is to be yours, and no one else may touch it. So you must do exactly as I tell you."
At the word treasure, Aladdin forgot his fears and grasped the ring as he was told, saying the names of his father and grandfather. The stone came up quite easily and some steps appeared.
"Go down," said the magician. "At the foot of those steps you will find an open door leading into three large halls. Tuck up your gown and go through them without touching anything, or you will die instantly. These halls lead into a garden of fine fruit trees. Walk on till you come to a niche in a terrace, where stands a lighted lamp. Pour out the oil it contains, and bring it to me."
He drew a ring from his finger and gave it to Aladdin, bidding him prosper. Aladdin found everything as the magician had said, gathered some fruit off the trees, and having got the lamp, arrived at the mouth of the cave. The magician cried out in a great hurry,
"Make haste and give me the lamp."
This Aladdin refused to do until he was out of the cave. The magician flew into a terrible passion, and throwing some more powder on the fire, he said something, and the stone rolled back into its place. The magician left Persia forever, which plainly showed that he was no uncle of Aladdin's, but a cunning magician, who had read in his magic books of a wonderful lamp, which would make him the most powerful man in the world. Though he alone knew where to find it, he could only receive it from the hand of another. He had picked out the foolish Aladdin for this purpose, intending to get the lamp and kill him afterwards. For 2 days Aladdin remained in the dark, crying and lamenting. At last he clasped his hands in prayer, and in so doing rubbed the ring, which the magician had forgotten to take from him. Immediately an enormous and frightful genie rose out of the earth, saying,
"What wouldst thou with me? I am the slave of the ring, and will obey thee in all things."
Aladdin fearlessly replied,
"Deliver me from this place."
Whereupon the earth opened, and he found himself outside. As soon as his eyes could bear the light, he went home, but fainted on the threshold. When he came to himself, he told his mother what had passed, and showed her the lamp and the fruits he had gathered in the garden, which were in reality precious stones. He then asked for some food.
"Alas, child," she said, "I have nothing in the house, but I have spun a little cotton, and will go and sell it."
Aladdin bade her keep her cotton, for he would sell the lamp instead. As it was very dirty, she began to rub it, that it might fetch a higher price.
Instantly a hideous genie appeared and asked what she would have. She fainted away, but Aladdin, snatching the lamp, said boldly,
"Fetch me something to eat."
The genie returned with a silver bowl, 12 silver plates containing rich meats, 2 silver cups, and 2 bottles of wine. Aladdin's mother, when she came to herself, said,
"Whence comes this splendid feast? Ask not, but eat,"
replied Aladdin. So they sat at breakfast till it was dinner time, and Aladdin told his mother about the lamp. She begged him to sell it and have nothing to do with devils.
"No," said Aladdin. "Since chance has made us aware of its virtues, we will use it, and the ring likewise, which I shall always wear on my finger."
When they had eaten all the genie had brought, Aladdin sold one of the silver plates, and so on, till none were left. He then had recourse to the genie, who gave him another set of plates, and thus they lived for many years. One day Aladdin heard an order from the Sultan proclaim that everyone was to stay at home and close his shutters while the princess, his daughter, went to and from the bath. Aladdin was seized by a desire to see her face, which was very difficult, as she always went veiled. He hid himself behind the door of the bath and peeped through a chink. The princess lifted her veil as she went in, and looked so beautiful that Aladdin fell in love with her at first sight. He went home so changed that his mother was frightened. He told her he loved the princess so deeply that he could not live without her, and meant to ask her in marriage of her father. His mother, on hearing this, burst out laughing, but Aladdin at last prevailed upon her to go before the Sultan and carry his request. She fetched a napkin and laid in it the magic fruits from the enchanted garden, which sparkled and shone like the most beautiful jewels. She took these with her to please the Sultan and set out, trusting in the lamp. The Grand Vizier and the Lords of Council had just gone in as she entered the hall and placed herself in front of the Sultan. He, however, took no notice of her. She went every day for a week and stood in the same place. When the council broke up on the 6th day, the Sultan said to the vizier,
"I see a certain woman in the audience chamber every day, carrying something in a napkin. Call her next time, that I may find out what she wants."
Next day, at a sign from the vizier, she went up to the foot of the throne and remained kneeling till the Sultan said to her,
"Rise, good woman, and tell me what you want."
She hesitated, so the Sultan sent away all but the vizier, and bade her speak freely, promising to forgive her beforehand for anything she might say. She then told him of her son's violent love for the princess.
"I prayed him to forget her," she said, "but in vain. He threatened to do some desperate deed if I refused to go and ask your majesty for the hand of the princess. Now I pray you to forgive not me alone, but my son Aladdin."
The Sultan asked her kindly what she had in the napkin, whereupon she unfolded the jewels and presented them. He was thunderstruck, and turning to the vizier said,
"What sayest thou? Ought I not to bestow the princess on one who values her at such a price?"
The vizier, who wanted her for his own son, begged the Sultan to withhold her for 3 months, in the course of which he hoped his son would contrive to make him a richer present. The Sultan granted this, and told Aladdin's mother that, though he consented to the marriage, she must not appear before him again for 3 months. Aladdin waited patiently for nearly 3 months, but after 2 had elapsed, his mother, going into the city to buy oil, found everyone rejoicing, and asked what was going on.
"Do you not know," was the answer, "that the son of the Grand Vizier is to marry the Sultan's daughter tonight?"
Breathless, she ran and told Aladdin, who was overwhelmed at first, but presently bethought him of the lamp. He rubbed it, and the genie appeared, saying,
"What is thy will?"
Aladdin replied,
"The Sultan, as thou knowest, has broken his promise to me, and the vizier's son is to have the princess. My command is that tonight you bring hither the bride and bridegroom."
"Master, I obey,"
said the genie. Aladdin then went to his chamber, where, sure enough, at midnight, the genie transported the bed containing the vizier's son and the princess.
"Take this new married man," he said,
and put him outside in the cold, and return at daybreak."
Whereupon the genie took the vizier's son out of bed, leaving Aladdin with the princess.
"Fear nothing," Aladdin said to her. "You are my wife, promised to me by your unjust father, and no harm shall come to you."
The princess was too frightened to speak, and passed the most miserable night of her life, while Aladdin lay down beside her and slept soundly. At the appointed hour, the genie fetched in the shivering bridegroom, laid him in his place, and transported the bed back to the palace. Presently, the sultan came to wish his daughter good morning. The unhappy vizier's son jumped up and hid himself, while the princess would not say a word, and was very sorrowful. The sultan sent her mother to her, who said,
"How comes it, child, that you will not speak to your father? What has happened?"
The princess sighed deeply, and at last told her mother how, during the night, the bed had been carried into some strange house, and what had passed there. Her mother did not believe her in the least, but bade her rise and consider it an idle dream. The following night exactly the same thing happened, and next morning, on the princess's refusing to speak, the sultan threatened to cut off her head. She then confessed all, bidding him ask the vizier's son, if it were not so. The sultan told the vizier to ask his son, who owned the truth, adding that, dearly as he loved the princess, he had rather die than go through another such fearful night, and wished to be separated from her. His wish was granted, and there was an end of feasting and rejoicing. When the 3 months were over, Aladdin sent his mother to remind the sultan of his promise. She stood in the same place as before, and the sultan, who had forgotten Aladdin, at once remembered him and sent for her. On seeing her poverty, the sultan felt less inclined than ever to keep his word, and asked the vizier's advice, who counseled him to set so high a value on the princess that no man living could come up to it. The sultan then turned to Aladdin's mother, saying,
"Good woman, a sultan must remember his promises, and I will remember mine. But your son must first send me 40 basins of gold, brimful of jewels, carried by 40 black slaves, led by as many white ones, splendidly dressed. Tell him that I await his answer."
The mother of Aladdin bowed low and went home, thinking all was lost. She gave Aladdin the message, adding,
"He may wait long enough for your answer."
"Not so long, mother, as you think," her son replied. "I would do a great deal more than that for the princess."
He summoned the genie, and in a few moments the 80 slaves arrived and filled up the small house and garden. Aladdin made them set out to the palace, two and two, followed by his mother. They were so richly dressed, with such splendid jewels in their girdles, that everyone crowded to see them and the basins of gold they carried on their heads. They entered the palace, and after kneeling before the sultan, stood in a half-circle round the throne with their arms crossed, while Aladdin's mother presented them to the sultan. He hesitated no longer, but said,
"Good woman, return and tell your son that I wait for him with open arms."
She lost no time in telling Aladdin, bidding him make haste, but Aladdin first called the genie.
"I want a scented bath," he said, "a richly embroidered habit, a horse surpassing the sultan's, and 20 slaves to attend me. Besides this, 6 slaves, beautifully dressed, to wait on my mother, and lastly, 10,000 pieces of gold in 10 purses."
No sooner said than done. Aladdin mounted his horse and passed through the streets, the slaves strewing gold as they went. Those who had played with him in his childhood knew him not, he had grown so handsome. When the sultan saw him, he came down from his throne, embraced him, and led him into a hall where a feast was spread, intending to marry him to the princess that very day. But Aladdin refused, saying,
"I must build a palace fit for her,"
and took his leave. Once home, he said to the genie,
"Build me a palace of the finest marble, set with jasper, agate, and other precious stones. In the middle you shall build me a large hall with a dome, its 4 walls of massy gold and silver, each side having 6 windows, whose lattices, all except one, which is to be left unfinished, must be set with diamonds and rubies.
There must be stables and horses and grooms and slaves. Go and see about it.
The palace was finished by next day, and the genie carried him there and, showing him all his orders faithfully carried out, even to the laying of a velvet carpet from Aladdin's palace to the Sultan's. Aladdin's mother then dressed herself carefully and walked to the palace with her slaves, while he followed her on horseback. The Sultan sent musicians with trumpets and cymbals to meet them, so that the air resounded with music and cheers. She was taken to the princess, who saluted her and treated her with great honor. At night, the princess said goodbye to her father and set out on the carpet for Aladdin's palace, with his mother at her side, and followed by the 100 slaves. She was charmed at the sight of Aladdin, who ran to receive her.
"Princess," he said, "blame your beauty for my boldness if I have displeased you."
She told him that, having seen him, she willingly obeyed her father in this matter. After the wedding had taken place, Aladdin led her into the hall, where a feast was spread, and she supped with him, after which they danced till midnight. Next day Aladdin invited the Sultan to see the palace. On entering the hall with the 24 windows, with their rubies, diamonds, and emeralds, he cried,
"It is a world's wonder. There is only one thing that surprises me. Was it by accident that one window was left unfinished?"
"No, sir, by design," returned Aladdin.
"I wished your majesty to have the glory of finishing this palace."
The Sultan was pleased and sent for the best jewelers in the city. He showed them the unfinished window and bade them fit it up like the others.
"Sir," replied their spokesman, "we cannot find jewels enough."
The Sultan had his own fetched, which they soon used, but to no purpose, for in a month's time the work was not half done. Aladdin, knowing that their task was vain, bade them undo their work and carry the jewels back, and the genie finished the window at his command. The Sultan was surprised to receive his jewels again, and visited Aladdin, who showed him the window finished. The Sultan embraced him, the envious vizier meanwhile hinting that it was the work of enchantment. Aladdin had won the hearts of the people by his gentle bearing. He was made captain of the Sultan's armies, and won several battles for him, but remained modest and courteous as before, and lived thus in peace and content for several years. But far away in Africa, the magician remembered Aladdin, and by his magic arts discovered that Aladdin, instead of perishing miserably in the cave, had escaped, and had married a princess, with whom he was living in great honor and wealth. He knew that the poor tailor's son could only have accomplished this by means of the lamp, and traveled night and day till he reached the capital of China, bent on Aladdin's ruin. As he passed through the town, he heard people talking everywhere about a marvelous palace.
"Forgive my ignorance," he asked. "What is this palace you speak of?"
"Have you not heard of Prince Aladdin's palace?" was the reply. "The greatest wonder of the world? I will direct you if you have a mind to see it."
The magician thanked him who spoke, and having seen the palace, knew that it had been raised by the genie of the lamp, and became half mad with rage. He determined to get hold of the lamp, and again plunge Aladdin into the deepest poverty. Unluckily, Aladdin had gone a-hunting for 8 days, which gave the magician plenty of time. He bought 12 copper lamps, put them into a basket, and went to the palace, crying,
"New lamps for old!"
followed by a jeering crowd. The princess, sitting in the hall of 24 windows, sent a slave to find out what the noise was about, who came back laughing, so that the princess scolded her.
"Madam," replied the slave, "who can help laughing to see an old fool offering to exchange fine new lamps for old ones?"
Another slave, hearing this, said,
"There is an old one on the cornice there which he can have."
Now this was the magic lamp, which Aladdin had left there, as he could not take it out hunting with him. The princess, not knowing its value, laughably bade the slave take it and make the exchange. She went and said to the magician,
"Give me a new lamp for this."
He snatched it and bade the slave take her choice, amid the jeers of the crowd. Little he cared, but left off crying his lamps, and went out of the city gates to a lonely place, where where he remained till nightfall, when he pulled out the lamp and rubbed it. The genie appeared, and at the magician's command carried him, together with the palace and the princess in it, to a lonely place in Africa. Next morning the sultan looked out of the window towards Aladdin's palace and rubbed his eyes, for it was gone. He sent for the vizier and asked what had become of the palace. The vizier looked out too, and was lost in astonishment. He again put it down to enchantment, and this time the sultan believed him, and sent 30 men on horseback to fetch Aladdin in chains. They met him riding home, bound him, and forced him to go with them on foot. The people, however, who loved him, followed, armed, to see that he came to no harm. He was carried before the sultan, who ordered the executioner to cut off his head. The executioner made Aladdin kneel down, bandaged his eyes, and raised his scimitar to strike. At that instant, the vizier, who saw that the crowd had forced their way into the courtyard and were scaling the walls to rescue Aladdin, called to the executioner to stay his hand. The people, indeed, looked so threatening that the sultan gave way and ordered Aladdin to be unbound and pardoned him in the sight of the crowd. Aladdin now begged to know what he had done.
"False wretch," said the sultan, "come hither,"
and showed him from the window the place where his palace had stood. Aladdin was so amazed that he could not say a word.
"Where is my palace and my daughter?" demanded the sultan. "For the first I am not so deeply concerned, but my daughter I must have, and you must find her or lose your head."
Aladdin begged for 40 days in which to find her, promising if he failed to return and suffer death at the sultan's pleasure. His prayer was granted, and he went forth sadly from the sultan's presence. For 3 days he wandered about like a madman, asking everyone what had become of his palace, but they only laughed and pitied him. He came to the banks of a river and knelt down to say his prayers before throwing himself in. In so doing, he rubbed the magic ring he still wore. The genie he had seen in the cave appeared and asked his will.
"Save my life, genie," said Aladdin, "and bring my palace back."
"That is not in my power," said the genie. "I am only the slave of the ring. You must ask the slave of the lamp."
"Even so," said Aladdin, "but thou canst take me to the palace and set me down under my dear wife's window."
He at once found himself in Africa, under the window of the princess, and fell asleep out of sheer weariness. He was awakened by the singing of the birds, and his heart was lighter. He saw plainly that all his misfortunes were owing to the loss of the lamp, and vainly wondered who had robbed him of it. That morning the princess rose earlier than she had done since she had been carried into Africa by the magician, whose company she was forced to endure once a day. She, however, treated him so harshly that he dared not live there altogether. As she was dressing, one of her women looked out and saw Aladdin. The princess ran and opened the window, and at the noise she made, Aladdin looked up. She called to him to come to her, and great was the joy of these lovers at seeing each other again. After he had kissed her, Aladdin said,
"I beg of you, princess, in God's name, before we speak of anything else, for your own sake and mine, tell me what has become of an old lamp I left on the cornice in the hall of 24 windows, when I went a-hunting."
"Alas," she said, "I am the innocent cause of our sorrows,"
and told him of the exchange of the lamp.
"Now I know," cried Aladdin, "that we have to thank the African magician for this. Where is the lamp?"
"He carries it about with him," said the princess. "I know, for he pulled it out of his breast to show me. He wishes me to break my faith with you and marry him, saying that you are beheaded by my father's command. He is forever speaking ill of you, but I only reply by my tears. If I persist, I doubt not but he will use violence."
Aladdin comforted her and left her for a while. He changed clothes with the first person he met in the town, and having bought a certain powder, returned to the princess, who let him in by a little side door.
"Put on your most beautiful dress," he said to her, "and receive the magician with smiles, leading him to believe that you have forgotten me. Invite him to sup with you,
and say you wish to taste the wine of his country. He will go for some, and while he is gone, I will tell you what to do."
She listened carefully to Aladdin, and when he left her, arrayed herself gaily for the first time since she left China. She put on a girdle and headdress of diamonds, and seeing in a glass that she looked more beautiful than ever, received the magician, saying to his great amazement,
"I have made up my mind that Aladdin is dead, and that all my tears will not bring him back to me. So I am resolved to mourn no more, and have therefore invited you to sup with me. But I am tired of the wines of China, and would fain taste those of Africa."
The magician flew to his cellar, and the princess put the powder Aladdin had given her in her cup. When he returned, she asked him to drink her health in the wine of Africa, handing him her cup in exchange for his, as a sign she was reconciled to him. Before drinking, the magician made her a speech in praise of her beauty, but the princess cut him short, saying,
"Let me drink first, and you shall say what you will afterwards."
She set her cup to her lips and kept it there, while the magician drained his to the dregs and fell back lifeless. The princess then opened the door to Aladdin and flung her arms round his neck, but Aladdin put her away, bidding her to leave him, as he had more to do. He then went to the dead magician, took the lamp out of his vest, and bade the genie carry the palace and all in it back to China. This was done, and the princess in her chamber only felt two little shocks, and little thought she was at home again. The sultan, who was sitting in his closet, mourning for his lost daughter, happened to look up and rubbed his eyes, for there stood the palace as before. He hastened thither, and Aladdin received him in the hall of the 24 windows, with the princess at his side. Aladdin told him what had happened, and showed him the dead body of the magician, that he might believe. A 10 days feast was proclaimed, and it seemed as if Aladdin might now live the rest of his life in peace. But it was not to be.